Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Al-Shabaab singles out victims who are non-Muslims. And in Austria, the talks over Iran's nuclear policies. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. Police in northeastern Kenya say Al-Shabaab gunmen ambushed a bus and killed 28 non-Muslims, singled out from the 60 passengers on the bus. Police officials say the militants seized the bus today, 50 kilometers from the Kenyan border with Somalia.
I've already ordered a combined security team to be able to carry out a major operation and a crackdown of the attackers.
Kenya has been hit by a series of gun and bomb attacks blamed on Al-Shabaab militants since it sent troops into Somalia to fight the Al-Qaeda-linked group in 2011. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says negotiators are making careful progress in talks in Vienna on the future of Iran's nuclear program, but he says serious gaps remain. VOA's Al Pessin reports from Vienna.
It was Secretary Kerry's first comment on the talk since he arrived on Thursday.
We've been obviously having difficult talks here. Complicated topic. We're working hard. We hope we're making careful progress. But we have big gaps.
Kerry met again with his Iranian counterpart, Mohammad Javad Zarif, and spent part of Saturday in telephone meetings with four foreign ministers from Persian Gulf countries, Qatar, Kuwait, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates. Al Pessin, VOA News, Vienna.
Vice President Joe Biden is calling on Europe to diversify its energy supplies in order to reduce dependence on Russia. Speaking at an energy summit in Istanbul today, Biden said now is the time to act and that Ukraine's energy supply problems only underscore the urgency. Russia has traditionally supplied Ukraine with gas but cut off supplies in a dispute over Ukraine's unpaid debts. This is VOA News. Members of the OPEC oil cartel will gather in Vienna this coming week to consider what action to take after a sharp decline in global oil prices. Cutting production could bolster prices, but there are many things to consider, as VOA's Jim Randall reports.
Economists say global oil prices have dropped because faltering economic growth and greater energy efficiency have cut demand for energy. At the same time, the supply of oil has grown significantly as U.S. drillers have expanded the use of fracking, a technology that helps them retrieve oil that is unrecoverable by simpler, cheaper techniques. Saudi Arabia can produce oil relatively cheaply, and some analysts say the Saudis might not cut production in a bid to let falling prices discourage competition and take a greater share of the market. Lower prices mean substantial amounts of money that had been buying imported oil can now be directed to other uses. Jim Randall, VOA News, Washington.
A prominent activist group monitoring Syria's civil war says U.S.-led airstrikes in the country have killed more than 900 people since the campaign against IS militants began in September. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says the toll includes more than 50 civilians, five of them women, eight of them children. But the group says the majority of those killed, a total of 785, were Islamic State fighters. In Mali, a new case of Ebola virus has been confirmed and two more patients are being tested for the disease. The government said in a statement on Saturday that the patient who tested positive for Ebola has been quarantined and is receiving intensive treatment. Mali is monitoring more than 300 people who had contact with Ebola patients in an effort to stop the spread of the virus. President Barack Obama says with his executive action on immigration that enforcement resources could be focused on felons, not families, and criminals, not children. The president, in his weekly address today, said that he waited for Congress to sign such a bill, but so far the leaders have refused.
It's the only thing standing in the way of that bipartisan bill and my desk so that I can sign that bill. The only thing that's been standing in the way is a simple yes or no vote in the House of Representatives. Just a yes or no vote.
President Obama signed two executive orders on Friday that will begin the process of offering temporary work permits and lift the threat of deportation for nearly 5 million undocumented immigrants. House of Representatives Speaker John Boehner said earlier Friday President Obama is damaging the presidency by bypassing Congress and that the House of Republicans will fight the action. A leading U.S. newspaper says President Barack Obama has signed a classified order extending the role of U.S. troops in Afghanistan for another year. The New York Times reports that the website, the order ensures American troops will have a direct role in fighting in the war-ravaged country for at least another year. I'm Marty Johnson reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
There are no asylum seekers in Ethiopia. There is a conceptual mistake. There are three concepts: refugees, migration, and asylum seekers.
A top Eritrean diplomat rejects the latest UN Refugee Commission report about citizens seeking asylum in Ethiopia.
And from the reading of this constitution, it's clear that the vice president cannot be removed in a manner that the first lady is talking about.
A Zimbabwean think tank says President Robert Mugabe lacks constitutional powers to fire his deputy Joyce Mujuru, who have a report.
The rate of transmission continues to increase in many places. We need more international responders, trained medical teams.
And the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon calls for more international response to combat the Ebola disease. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Eritrea's top diplomat to the United Nations says the UN High Commission for Refugees has committed a key conceptual mistake in a report. It says that in the past 37 days, more than 6,000 Eritreans had claimed asylum in neighboring Ethiopia. The UN Refugee Agency said Eritrea's renewed conscription drive is to blame for the sharp increase in the number of youths fleeing the country. But Eritrea's ambassador to the United Nations, Girma Asmerum, told me earlier that the report was a calculated effort to undermine the government by creating disaffection among its population.
The UN has to do a bit of its homework, you know, because there are no asylum seekers in Ethiopia. There is a conceptual mistake. There are three concepts: refugees, migration, and asylum seekers. Is there migration from Eritrea? Yes. It is a global phenomenon, as it is happening all over the world. I mean, there is almost 32 million people migrating to different parts of the world. So we really don't understand why they are conculcating certain terminologies of asylum seekers. A refugee kind of concept does not really fit into the Eritrean picture. And in Ethiopia, you don't ask asylum seekers. These are in camps. In fact, what we have in Ethiopia is detention camps.
But Ambassador, some human rights groups are blaming your government policy of perpetual national service for young men and women, running away from this concept and policy to seek asylum outside the country, especially in neighboring Ethiopia. What do you say to that?
This is a part of the defamation and disinformation campaign. It's a PR exercise by the Ethiopian government and the UNHCR, which are looking for funding. You know, they have to have a poster child, you know, to get the funding. Ethiopia gets a foreign exchange return on this issue of claiming there are refugees or asylum seekers. Countries. These are transit countries. And you'll find Eritreans, even Kenyans, Ugandans, even Ethiopians all over the world, you know, trying to transit through Africa, through Uganda, Kenya, South Sudan, even most of them going to South Sudan. You don't see camps in South Sudan. All this kind of issue is a global issue. So I really don't understand why they target Eritrea for a specific. But also it's an agenda to weaken Eritrea and also to demonize and decapacitate the capacity of the Eritrean army to defend its sovereignty. While our country is occupied, they are calling for us to abandon the national service. It's not the national service that's really a problem. It's a deliberate distortion.
Your country has been accused of poor human rights record as part of the motivating factor or the catalyst that makes your young men and women want to leave the country rather than stay and help build the country up. What do you say to that?
All what we can do is explain to the public, come and see Eritrea. Inside situations, this is a country where there is really peace. You know, you don't even find any of the ministers having bodyguards, including in the entire Eritrea, except the airport. You don't even see metal detectors, electronic metal detectors, including the president's office. You don't get really searched. You just go in. So that is the most peaceful country, with 50% Christian, 50% Muslim. You can walk, and after midnight, and nothing will happen to you. So it's the most peaceful. Even when you talk about the so-called refugee, there is always internally displaced refugees. And if you look at Somalia, South Sudan, and even in Syria, what happens is those areas are at war. People will be internally displaced, and some would cross over to the other area and become refugees. But in Eritrean case, it's the most below. Most of them are, in fact, trafficked, human trafficking. They are victims. I can give you the price to go to Ethiopia, how much they pay, to go through Ethiopia, to go through Sudan, how much they pay. So this is a global phenomenon, migration. Is there poverty? Yes. But in terms of accusation, these are just baseless allegations. But they have to create a pretext for their funding exercise.
Now, what is the motivation for people to demonize your country? Critics of your country say it has been a pariah, and that the government has been in power since independence. There's no democracy. Constitution has been suspended. These are some of the criticisms that are leveled against your administration of being not transparent. What do you say to those criticisms?
This is an insult not to the government, to tell you frankly. The Eritrean people know who they are, what they want, how they live. So this should be left to the people of Eritrea.
Girma Asmeram is the Eritrean top diplomat to the United Nations. He spoke with me from New York. The General Secretary of Zambia's ruling Patriotic Front says the decision by the party's Central Committee to suspend President Guy Scott as party leader is illegal. General Secretary Bridget Atanga called the suspension null and void. These conflicting accounts of who is in charge are raising concerns about the party's chances in the January by-election to replace the late President Michael Sata. Leonard Hikaumba, president of the Zambia Congress of Trade Unions, told me earlier that the ruling PF is suffering from a leadership crisis which, if not properly managed, could erode Zambia's confidence in the party's ability to govern.
Well, it's quite unfortunate because that's the ruling party at the moment. And if there can be such levels of confusion, it will simply undermine the trust that the people had in the ruling party. Because as a ruling party, they are supposed to be seen to be well organized, so that that kind of organization can give confidence to the people that even if the party is entrusted with the presidency again, we shall have continued peace and a clear path of direction.
Are you therefore saying that the apparent confusion or alleged confusion within the rank and file of the ruling party or the Patriotic Front could undermine their chances of winning re-election?
Exactly, because what is likely to happen is that if the process of selecting the candidate is not well managed, some people will be frustrated, their supporters will equally be frustrated, and they may simply opt to support somebody else other than the candidate from their own party. That is why they needed to exercise caution and restraint against any approaches that would appear, chaotic, especially to the onlookers.
People are suggesting that deceased President Sata, who was then a unifier of the party, this apparent confusion does not bode well for his legacy within the party. What do you make of it?
Well, it's true. He held the party together quite well, and it's unfortunate that his departure has left such a vacuum that there is no one who seems to wield enough authority to continue with that kind of unity that was there.
But there were supposed to be guidelines that will guide all these
processes to ensure a successor is chosen to lead the party in the presidential by-election. Why is there so much confusion about who should lead the party, even when the interim president was chosen, knowing very well that he's not eligible?
Well, we need so to understand, because the party has a constitution and the party has structures which have well-defined functions, and it was our considered view that they would have used the party constitution to determine, manage this process of selecting the presidential candidate. But as the situation stands, it appears that the party manifesto, the party constitution is being interpreted differently by different people. Whereas there is a group that contends that the central committee has the power, other people are saying it's the general council that has the power. So we see this kind of confusion because of the failure to come up with a clear, interpretation of what the constitution says and who wields the power to select the presidential candidate.
Leonard Hikaumba is the president of the Zambia Congress of Trade Unions. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe does not have constitutional powers to fire his deputy, Joyce Mujuru, as is being demanded by his wife, Grace. Local think tank, the Zimbabwe Democracy Institute, says this explains the attacks the First Lady has been leading in trying to force Mrs. Mujuru to resign from her position. For VOA, Thomas Chiripazi has details from the capital, Harare.
Speaking to Studio 7 in Harare earlier today, Director of the Zimbabwe Democracy Institute, Pedzisai Ruhanya, said the country's new constitution, adopted at a referendum ahead of last year's elections, does not give President Mugabe the power to dismiss beleaguered Vice President Mujuru. First Lady Grace Mugabe, who is said to become the boss of ZANU-PF's Women's League at the ruling party's elective congress set for next month, has repeatedly called for Mrs. Mujuru's ouster, accusing her of corruption, incompetence, and allegedly plotting to assassinate her husband. This week, the First Lady called on Mr. Mugabe to fire Mrs. Mujuru, but Ruhanya says that is a no-go area.
It is very clear that the Senate and the National Assembly, that is Parliament, by a joint resolution passed by all, by at least one half of their total membership. And by total membership, it also includes the MDC. Members of the MDC, they will also be implicated in the removal of the president or vice president. So President Mugabe, on his own, from the reading, this literal reading of the Constitution, he doesn't have those powers. I also looked at the transitional clauses, and it is not clearly expressed or clearly stated, because this is a serious matter. It doesn't need interpretation. It must be very clear the steps that are supposed to be used when you want to remove a president of the country or a vice president of the country. And from the reading of this constitution, it's clear that the vice president cannot be removed in a manner that the First Lady is talking about, in a manner that Muchangwa and the others are talking about. This is why they are saying that she must be removed, she must be dead, that she must resign on her own. I think the ZANU-PF legal think tanks, if you told Mugabe of the legal minefield that he faces, should he decide to do that, but knowing ZANU for what it is, Mugabe can decide to act unlawfully and unconstitutionally, because that has been the hallmark of his rule. He does things that are very unlawful, things that are very unconstitutional. That's why even in the statement of the vice president, she talks about the unconstitutional removal. Because I think that those who advise her have read this constitution properly and saw that in terms of the legal constitutional position, the literal reading of this constitution, the president cannot do that. That's why she is acting vice president in his absence.
Ruhanya added that Mr. Mugabe may also find it difficult to find support in both houses of parliament arguing that Mrs. Mujuru still has control in both houses.
I don't think they will have that capacity because she also commands a lot of sympathizers. If you look at those chairpersons, those people who have been removed in the provinces, they are part of her followers. And the complication is worse because when we talk about parliament, that is the Senate and the House of Assembly, we are talking about the members of the MDC who are in there. They are implicated. This is no longer a ZANU-PF Congress. When we are talking about the removal of the president, we are talking about a national issue, and it is resolved by a national assembly, which is parliament, sitting as Senate and as the House of Assembly. So they cannot do that.
Some political analysts say the internal fissures in ZANU-PF ahead of its Congress were exacerbated by President Mugabe's failure to groom a successor, as was done by other regional leaders like Mwalimu Julius Nyerere, avoiding fissures that are seen by many to be destroying the ZANU-PF fabric. Mujuru and Justice Minister Emmerson Mnangagwa are reportedly leading factions angling to succeed Mr. Mugabe when he eventually leaves office. But the two faction leaders have publicly denied this, saying they are all rallying behind President Mugabe. Reporting for Studio 7 from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
In Sierra Leone, the spread of the Ebola virus has been increasing. The epicenter has now shifted to the capital city, Freetown. The mayor of Freetown says he will introduce new measures to curb the transmission. For VOA, reporter Kelvin Lewis has the details from Freetown.
It is now 7 months since the first case of Ebola was discovered in Sierra Leone. The mayor of the capital city, Freetown, is Franklin Body Gibson. He says he has buried a large number of people.
To be precise, I can tell you without any exaggeration that the Freetown City Council have buried about 2,200 corpses since the start of the disease.
Not all the 2,200 deaths are attributable to Ebola, but official figures say over 1,200 deaths have been from Ebola. Even this week, two medical doctors, making seven, have died of Ebola. With over 500 people catching the virus every week, Mayor Gibson says he will prepare a new cemetery.
Now we, as I speak to you, I'm pretty sure we're still keeping about 1,000 more spaces for burials. When we should have exhausted that, then we will have to transfer burials to somewhere in the east at Allentown, for which we are now working on the land.
Transmission of the Ebola virus is mainly through contact. Mayor Gibson says he will introduce new measures to help stop the transmission.
That is why you see we are now introducing many laws, new ones, telling people they don't sell on the streets at night. They close at 6 and everybody goes away. We are looking at other possibilities of trying to cut down on the crowd, especially in the market areas.
The mayor says he's optimistic the spread of Ebola will end soon.
I have calculated that what we have at King Tom for another 1,000 could last for about 3 weeks. The new cemetery on Allentown is about 6 acres. And we're still calculating that 6 acres can accommodate up to 6,000, 7,000. Despite we are not anticipating that we'll have those numbers of death by the time Ebola ends, because I am looking at the end of Ebola to be sometime around the 15th, 16th of December.
The mayor advised Sierra Leoneans to change their behavioral attitudes so that the chain of transmission of the virus can be broken. For VOA Africa, I'm Kelvin Lewis reporting from Freetown, Sierra Leone.
The United Nations Secretary General has said there is progress in managing the Ebola crisis in West Africa.
Ban Ki-moon said with the United Nations partner agency scaling up action, there is hope the outbreak could be brought under control and subsequently eradicated. From Washington, my colleague Douglas Impuga has more.
The UN Secretary General said the UN system will do all it takes to help the affected countries stop the spread of Ebola, treat the infected people, and ensure that all essential services are provided. Ban Ki-moon, who was speaking to reporters Friday in Washington after the UN Chief's Executive Board's meeting on Ebola response, also pledged to preserve the stability of the countries affected and to prevent further outbreaks.
Our results to date are uneven. The rate of transmission continues to increase in many places. We need more international responders, trained medical teams, and volunteer health workers, especially in remote districts. And we need to avoid travel bans, discrimination against the health workers, and other steps that would isolate countries when they need help most.
He cautioned, however, that there's still a lot of work to be done.
There has been some welcome progress where the Ebola response strategy is implemented. The rate of new cases appears to be slowing. We are seeing the curve bending in enough places to give us hope.
The Secretary General commended local governments and communities for coordinating their efforts with the UN system and expressed gratitude to those countries in the international community that are giving life-saving contributions.
If we continue to accelerate our response, we can contain and end the outbreak by the middle of next year.
He said the effects of Ebola will long outlast the outbreak and called on the national community to stay engaged. The Director General of the World Health Organization, Dr. Margaret Chan, said a lot more needs to be done to eradicate the Ebola outbreak.
We must not forget, Ebola virus is a formidable enemy. Yes, we are seeing some early signals of hope. Cases are stabilizing. But as Mr. Secretary General was saying, we are also seeing some new areas where they are reporting new cases. So the answer is we must maintain our vigilance. Complacency would be our enemy. And in order to get it to zero, we have been successful in bending the curve a bit, but we need to continue to do more to get to zero.
A high-level UN team led by Dr. Chan has left for Mali, where they will discuss with the government there on the best way forward in containing and eradicating the disease. Reporting for VOA, I'm Douglas Impoga in Washington.
Hello, this is Sunday Shomari. Join me every Monday for your lighthearted show, Let's Talk. That's right, Monday at 17:30 UTC for interviews, great music, and a whole lot of laughter. Right here at the VOA Africa. Keep it locked. VOA Africa. Don't miss.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for VOA's discussion program, Reporters Roundtable, every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas and take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. So please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA.
And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent, then we will have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies in Comparative Politics at Howard University. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy.
I get this friend where we get from Calabar, Labake, Friday. Come to think she be my personal person. But anytime when she come around, she get this feeling where they do me like fever. And when she dance with my messy boo, he they be me like Senna for Panya. Me like how she play the bass line. It makes me sing ooh la la la. The way she the way she dance. It makes me sing ooh la la la. Oh yeah. When mommy come back, she a jump. Daddy come to me a cross. And when they ask me, it was me. That's what me talk say. I don't like this shirt, but your body. But you don't say my mama no like them. I don't want this shirt for your body. But you don't say my papa no like them. Cause it ups and follow me. Oh na 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 na. Oh na 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 na. Oh na 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 na.
thing where they chop you na mosquito. It go make you na mosquito. It they call you my money. That thing where they chop you na mosquito. It go make you spend money. It go chop somebody. It go kill somebody. 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 It go chop somebody. It go chop somebody.
I don't pay for Lagos. No be you, but they show me Lagos. Whether you be plus or minus. She they call me on it, make I drop. I no be monkey, go find job. If you try to be funny, baby, stop. That thing where they chop you, na mosquito. It go make you spend money. That thing where they chop you, na mosquito. It go make you spend money. That thing where they chop you, na mosquito. It they call you my money. That thing where they chop you, na mosquito. It go make you spend money. It go chop somebody. It go kill somebody. It go chop somebody.
dance yo. Oh, you make I sexy body, oh, you make me rock the door.
Oh, she don't need to go 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 roll before she dance yo.
EFA. Baby girl, now it's okay. I'll be on my guy, go babe. Don't put it in go babe.
But to me, you're the sun. I see a lot of fine girls, but to me, you're the one. Never take you to cloud nine, like a faithful airline. Other guys that'll fall back, like Popeye Jasko's hairline. We can party all night, I'm feeling all right. Your dress is all tight, your skin, they shine bright. Like saying, I touch like I love at first sight. Cause me, you're the fan. I don't know your name, but nice to meet ya. You should follow me, I ain't talking Twitter. You're my number one like a goalkeeper. And my number one goal is to keep ya.
Baby, girl, no, it's okay.
Open and close well like a door. Can I get your handle? To the car with the second friend.
Got me great party girls. Spells on the beat. Let go. Yo. Yeah, for me, love, get them. More rap, more rap, rap. It's good to be grateful. It's good to be grateful. Yeah, for me, love, get them. More rap.
eru to pe go be lo ma dale. I want to buy a lonely jale. Tell her that voice made a good of
the way she dance, the way she move, the way she dey wine, that's where she move. Makes me want to call him my baby. Oh yeah, dance with me, my lady.
Then go put this love on you, yeah. Don't go low, don't go low, yeah. Don't go low, don't go low, don't go low, don't go low, yeah. Don't go low, don't go low.
The love I receive for your eyes, I give all that you need and I won't think twice. It's double six when I throw the dice, yo. Oh girl, I'm loving your size, yo. There is no deceiving, with you girl I'm winning. The way you do the things you do, you make me scream what I'm feeling. Oh girl, you give me the healing, I'm down for your feeling. The way you do the things you do, you.
And that was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Every week, I pay close attention to the passing events in the world, and I pay close attention to American policy towards Africa and African opinions on and attitudes toward the United States. This week, there are many events going on around the world, and they have implications for U.S. policy towards Africa. Most importantly, from my point of view, is the conference in Asia where President Obama visited China and then went to the Asia-Pacific, or what some people now call the Trans-Pacific Alliance. Now, there are a number of things to be done with regard to this situation. One is the African summit took place a couple of months ago, and 50 African states assembled in the United States. And this was a very important development in terms of U.S. policy towards Africa. When you look back after the summit and what transpired since then, of course, unfortunately for most of the African countries and the African media, Ebola became dominant. It became the most discussed issue in the American media and in American society. So if you're looking at American policy towards Africa, you have to identify what transpired after the summit, and how U.S. policy is affecting Africa and African opinions on and attitudes toward the United States is affected. With Ebola, the U.S. intervened strongly on the humanitarian ground in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and of course Guinea, but most importantly, Liberia and Sierra Leone. These two countries do have historical relevance with regard to the English-speaking people and their relationship with black people historically. Sierra Leone, of course, has Freetown, the name of the country's capital, which goes back to the abolitionist movement. And you can see how Sierra Leone is very much linked not only to the abolitionist movement and the slave trade, but it's also linked to malaria. And of course, the former president of Sierra Leone, Sagar Stevens, immortalized the African encounter with malaria by creating the so-called Malaria Award. So if you're looking at American policy towards Africa, you try to look at these historical connections, anecdotes, similes, metaphors, and analogies, and see how they affect American policy towards Africa. Today, the Center for Disease Control, which was unknown to many Africans, is now very much part of the African vocabulary, particularly in Sierra Leone and Liberia and Guinea. And you can even go all the way to Nigeria, because Nigeria was briefly affected so was Senegal. But these two countries became Ebola-free for some reason. And today, the center of attraction of American policy with regard to Ebola is Liberia. And of course, the incident involving a Liberian in Texas, a big state in the United States, also affected not only Texans, people from Houston, and American policy towards Africa. So when you look at the Obama phenomena with regard to what is happening between the United States and Africa, the United States and the rest of the world, the development in Asia has consequences for Africa because the South Africans have strong relationships now with these Asian countries. And South Africa is the only African country which is a member of BRICS, meaning Brazil, Russia, India, and China. This is a new coalition of non-Western countries who are now beginning to create a new dialogue in world affairs. And they have implications for Africa. They are likely to affect U.S.-Africa relations. So two points need to be underscored here. One is President Obama's visit to China and his visit to the Asia summit has implications for Africa because if the Chinese can work out an economic deal with America, then you have a new relationship in world trade because the Chinese economy is rising. And now some of the economies are anticipating that the Chinese may become the number one economy. If that is true, there is still a relationship between the Chinese and the United States. But how does that affect Africa's policy? And this is where the Africans have to pay close attention to what the summit in Asia means for Africa. Because Brazil has a relationship with Africa. Russia has a relationship with Africa. India has a relationship with Africa. And of course, most importantly now, the Chinese. So this is a bone of contention for the bloggers, the protesters on television, for the journalists in Africa. So I will not be surprised to see many editorials written by African journalists all over the continent and all these Africans who have their internet blogging going on. The second point that needs to be underscored here is how does that summit in Asia affect Africa? During the Cold War, when Truman was trying to contain communism, the African countries, Asian countries were all involved. You have NATO, and they have CETO, which involves so many Southeast Asian countries that were fighting the communists. And of course, you also have CENTO, which didn't last long because the Arabs were opposed to it, particularly NASA and the Arab nationalists. And of course, today, when we look at the rise of BRICS and the manner in which BRICS can negotiate positively with the West in coming up with a new political disposition in the world. The African leaders who had a summit with the United States and had organized summits with China, India, and Japan, and Brazil in their own ways. The last question to be asked then is, where are the Africans going and how are they going to engage America so that before President Obama's term comes to an end, another summit which will be conceptualized differently and formulated differently so that this time you'll have long-lasting relationship between the United States and Africa. And this is the bone of contention. And this is what both American leaders on this side of the aisle, or the Atlantic, where now the Republicans are going to dominate the Senate and the Congress, and they have to negotiate successfully with the president to come up with a new Africa policy in this new debate against BRICS. And that's the way it is today, and I leave it that way.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, John Dryden, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the African elders say, when deeds speak, words are nothing. I'm Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. President Barack Obama and Chinese President Xi Jinping have made an ambitious announcement to fight climate change, with both countries setting significant goals to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. As the world's two largest economies, energy consumers, and emitters of greenhouse gases, we have a special responsibility to lead the global effort against climate change, said President Obama.
That's why today I am proud that we can announce a historic agreement. I commend President Xi, his team, and the Chinese government for the commitment they are making to slow, peak, and then reverse the course of China's carbon emissions.
For the first time, China has announced a peak year for its carbon emissions of around 2030 and will make a best effort to peak early. It also intends to increase the share of non-fossil fuels in primary energy consumption to around 20% by 2030. For its part, the U.S. has set a new goal of reducing net greenhouse gas emissions by 26 to 28% below 2005 levels by the year 2025. This is an ambitious goal, said President Obama, but it is an achievable goal.
It will double the pace at which we're reducing carbon pollution in the United States. It puts us on a path to achieving the deep emissions reductions by advanced economies that the scientific community says is necessary to prevent the most catastrophic effects of climate change. It will help improve public health. It will grow our economy. It will create jobs. It will strengthen our energy security. And it will put both of our nations on the path to a low-carbon economy.
Both countries will continue to strengthen their energy technology cooperation, which is essential to achieving steep greenhouse gas reductions in the coming decades. The two countries also launched a range of new initiatives to boost clean energy research, make carbon capture and storage a reality, link up our cities as they pursue low-carbon solutions, and promote green trade between our countries, measures that will strengthen and expand cooperation using existing platforms. This is a major milestone in the U.S.-China relationship, said President Obama.
By making this announcement today, together, we hope to encourage all major economies to be ambitious. All countries, developing and developed, to work across some of the old divides so we can conclude a strong global climate agreement next year.
When we work together, said President Obama, it's good for the United States, it's good for China, and it is good for the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.